Welcome to the Art Scene, brought to you each week by UALR Public Radio. If All Arkansas Read the Same Book is a project begun in 2001, when the Arkansas State Library chose a book that it then introduced statewide, also bringing in the author to encourage a wider reading public. The first author was Terry Kaye, and his book, To Dance with a White Dog. To read is one of the greatest of gifts, to be immersed in a book, a story, to the exclusion of all else. What could be better? It gets better for me because I can talk about the book with the author. And the 2015 State Library choice is Jenny Wingfield and her novel, her first, The Homecoming of Samuel Lake. Born in Arkansas, she grew up in Louisiana, is a graduate of Southern Arkansas University, taught school in Hope and Ashdown, and now lives in Texas. Her book is wonderful, has had glowing reviews such as a spectacular ensemble of unforgettable characters, or Wingfield's sense of people and place is uncanny. I know I couldn't bear to put it down. So what started it?
You know what? I never had in my life thought about writing about any of this. I wanted to write a play. And so I was planning a set where all you'd have to do would be move the lights, where you didn't have to change the stage. So I envisioned a house where the people lived. And then I wanted to bring in other people from the community. So you bring other people into a business. And so I remembered that my grandmother had a store attached to the front of her house. And that seemed great. You bring in everybody from the neighborhood. And then, well, the other end of the house, what could be happening down there? What's totally opposite? And my grandfather was a bootlegger. And I thought, okay, that would be a whole different world, you know, than the normal everybody comes in and buys milk or everybody gets gasoline. So I just built this in my mind, and then I sat down to write, and the first thing I wrote was John Moses couldn't have chosen a worse day or worse way to die if he planned it for a lifetime, which was possible. And from that point, it was a book. It wasn't going to be a play because it already wanted to be a book. And I just started telling the story as it came to me. And I did outline to an extent. I wrote an outline and then set it aside and really didn't stick to it at all. But it was good that I did it because it made me decide in my mind where things happened and who was with whom. But the story wrote itself. Every day it told me where to go.
Really?
Honestly, writing can be really, really hard work, or it can be like dancing. And that story, writing it, was like dancing. It just had its own rhythm, and it was fun to write.
It's fun to read. The Homecoming of Samuel Lake has so many characters, and they're all so strong and have such extraordinary impact on the story that when I was reading through it, I thought, how on earth did you keep track of all these people that you brought in? And then I thought, well, it's set in Southwest Arkansas, and I've noticed that Arkansans know each and every name, generation, who was married to whom and who begat which, that these stories you were talking about with these people that you called into place were like a family, and you wouldn't have any trouble remembering which one you were talking about, where I had to remember.
You know, it is like a family. And, well, of course, a lot of these characters are also based on members of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made it really easy. But the thing is, when you're writing a story, the whole crew becomes a family, and you remember it just as easily as you remember Aunt Ida or, you know, or Cousin Joe or whatever. sometimes a story carries you. You can start writing a story, and it takes over, and it carries you, and it tells you where it wants to go.
Yes, and this has some story. And you bring in all the major characters within the first few chapters. You start off the book with that story about John.
Yes.
And then you take another two chapters to establish who he was, why, the family he came from, and enough other characters. And you are so clever or so instinctively right in where you put the different groups of characters. Like the most, for me, the most important and the most significant was the children.
Right.
They were the ones that knew ahead of time what was happening and where they were needed. They were very quick to pick up on the evil in the story from the very first time that they saw Raz.
Right.
And because he was being cruel and had done an unnecessarily cruel blow on his small son.
You know, kids are very intuitive, though. They can sense things. When we're adults, we reason things out and we decide what it probably meant. Kids know. They understand danger and they understand evil. They understand cruelty. They understand that it's wrong and that it's something you try to shy away from and you try not to get in the way of it because it could destroy you.
Yes, and this wonderful little group, very much led by Swan, she had a something extra in her genes that you make her this a singer of an unusually beautiful voice, even young as she is. She's 12 going on 13 at the start of the book.
Yeah.
And it takes about, what, a year and a half?
About a year, yeah.
And each one of the vital people who make the ups and downs, and you begin to realize where the story is going without knowing exactly what's going on. You have to add the little bits, but it's the little bits that drive it. And how did you, because of the number of times where the sort of veins of good and veins of evil cross and crisscross, how you could stop it getting too far ahead of you?
You know, that was probably the simplest thing because a long time ago, I found out, I used to teach literature to seventh and eighth graders, and I realized that in any good story, you never let anything go on too long. If it's exciting, you know, enjoy the hell out of it, but cut it off quickly enough. If somebody's happy, let them really be happy, but don't let them just go on and on because we don't want to keep feeling the same thing. It's like, there again, it's like dancing. Dancing would not be fun to do the same step, do the same step, do the same step. Dancing is fun when we really move and we really let the music take over. So you don't let anybody be too happy too long, too sad too long, too frightened too long, too defeated too long. Whatever is happening, life is change. You know that's what life is. It's constant change. So that part was easy. I hope I answered your question.
Well, to a degree, because you brought in the major figures fairly early on, and you didn't really add to them to change the story.
Right.
You got the good, you got the evil, you got the family, you got the way they were all so well together. You got the grandmother and the grandfather who had a falling out and never resolved it, which absolutely killed the father because he couldn't find the words to say he was sorry, I guess. Uh-huh. And it was something that after he had killed himself that she realized she couldn't say she was sorry. And so it's a book that starts with violence and there's violence within it. there's an incredible amount of love. And who has it the most, what it does to help and what it doesn't. But it didn't reach me, except for the fact that the title is called The Homecoming of Samuel Lake. When he came in, I didn't see him as the incredibly significant person he became.
I'll tell you a secret. It's not, the name of the story was not, to begin with, The Homecoming of Samuel Lake. The story, I titled the story, Moses Never Closes. To me, that bar, that house, that store, that's Moses Never Closes. And Moses Never Closes is a character. And that's what I wanted it to be. Then you get vetoed sometimes by editors, and they have their own wisdom, and they know the book trade and so forth. But that was what I wanted it to be, because I never saw it as one person's story at all. I just saw it the story of a place where people, where things have gone along one way until something happens that changes everything.
Mm-hmm. The description of Samuel, his physical description, he sounded like God's gift to heroes.
He was my dad. He was so modeled after my dad. My dad had that black, curly hair, the blue eyes. And he was big, and he was strong, and he was funny, and he could play any musical instrument. And he was strict, and he was stern, and he was unreasonable in his strictness. But he was love.
Did he have...
He was magic.
Okay. Did he have the same connection with God that Samuel does?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's where I got all that. When I started that story, I never intended to... I really kind of intended, like, let him have a wreck on the way home from conference and just die and not be there, because I couldn't figure how to write about a preacher. What can you write about a preacher? People write holy men. My father was a holy man. He was a righteous man. I mean, he really always did what he thought was right. He always, always did whatever he thought was right. But he wasn't this holy man. But he also, people write about preachers as charlatans and con men. Well, he definitely wasn't that. And I didn't want to try to explain religion. I surely didn't want to convert anybody. I just wanted to tell a story. But he kind of insisted that he was going to be there. And, I mean, the character did. And so I let him be there. But then I had to be honest about what he was really like. I mean, he and my mother really loved each other, which always, when you're growing up and you see people in the church, you never can imagine mm-hmm. all these righteous people having, in those days, you couldn't imagine them having romantic thoughts or physical relationships or being real. They weren't like real flesh and blood. Well, I knew my parents were, you know.
Well, you certainly make it very clear in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the incredible love for the two of them. How do you pronounce it? Willoughby?
Willoughby, yes.
And her love, her total acceptance that she wasn't, in the light of, say, Bernice and some of the other people in the story, any competition at all. In, when it came to attracting somebody as tall and wonderful and handsome as Samuel. But they had a special relationship, as they say.
Yeah.
You know who you want to be with, and if you're lucky, the other person knows it too.
Yeah.
And it's delightful hearing their give and take on several occasions. And the children all take it for granted that their parents are loving each other and love everybody else. And the three in the immediate family that Swan holds sway over are each individually, they don't stand large on the horizon except for Swan, but they're vital to the story and to the support she needs.
Right.
And then her heart is as big as the world. Anybody who's hurt or hurting, she is determined to help. And what she does for Blade, this poor young, unfortunate son of this brutal man, he was lucky even to have been able to beget a good man.
Yeah. Well, there again, those people are modeled after people. When you see incredible evil in the real, when a writer sees incredible evil, sometimes you think you're never going to write about that. But then those people sneak into your story. I didn't know until that pickup truck drove up at the gas pumps that man would be in the story. I had no idea what part he would play. It's just suddenly he was. And
so where did his physical shape and size come from in your mind?
It's a real person. It's a real person. He's dead. He's gone. But I had witnessed that. I had seen that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everybody's there. Either someone I knew or some composite of people I knew, like the uncles kind of blend together. You know, it's not one uncle. But mother had a lot of brothers, and they were wonderful. And so the uncles are kind of composites of each other, you know.
My guest is Jenny Wingfield, and we're talking about her novel, The Homecoming of Samuel Lake. It will haunt you.
When I wrote this, our family, I love the way, this was mother's family, it wasn't my dad's family, but I love the way my mother's family, they were matter-of-fact about life. They knew how to enjoy life. They knew how to laugh. They knew what mattered, you know, when all was said and done, what really counted. And yet the men didn't laugh too loud. The men didn't say too much. Their eyes would twinkle, you know, rather than saying too much. You had to read what was in their minds. It was a wonderful bunch of people, and they just wanted to be on paper, I guess.
So was Toy a relative, too?
Oh, yes. Yes. But Toy is another composite.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just one person. He's several people rolled into one. But it's like I've seen that kind of character, you know, not just in my mother's family, but in the people I know in the South. We grew up with, moving from pillar to post and church to church and little small towns. And I knew these country people and people whose values were,
mm-hmm.
you know, do the right thing. You never have to regret it. You know, tell the truth. You don't have to regret it. Work hard. You know, that's how you feed your family. You know, they had these kind of simple, basic values, and they also knew that you balance all that hard work with, you know, go fishing.
Well,
eat good food, laugh, play some music, have a good time.
And the way you bring Toy in, if he is a composite, he's had quite a history with his
yes.
war runes and then coming back to his beautiful wife and what she is, that you must have disliked her intensely, the way that you built her through to her final denouement. But Toy and Swan had to understand each other's suffering, I guess, before she got to where she wanted to be. Close enough to bond with him while he carried her on his shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah, and she had to be a pain in the ass first.
Yes.
Toy had lots of difficulty.
Yeah. But then you bring in other aspects of life in this community, and I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear to read what Ras did to the horse.
Yeah.
And when he brought it in, and I wondered if it was a major factor in bringing that character into that story that changed the direction of your story somewhat.
Once he came in, he did change things, because when I started out with this story, I was just going to have these kids having fun spending the summer with their grandparents, which wouldn't have made much of a story, you know. But I was having fun writing it. I was having fun describing my grandfather, who was a contrary, you know, a really literate, smart man who at the same time was not an educated man. I mean, he read, he loved stories. There were all these opposites in him. But I was having a good time describing him and the kids. And then my grandfather really did kill himself. He really did kill himself at a family get-together. And, of course, you know, it came into the story. And then what would the family do? Well, they're close, so they stay open. So who would keep it? You know, it was all these things. It just, the story just happened. And then the only reason Ras Ballinger came into the story was because at that point I'd had Swan and Toy say everything they needed to say in that conversation, and I needed to change the subject, so let somebody drive up out front. Okay, so it's a red pickup truck. Okay, it's Ras Ballinger. He just drove himself into the story.
Well, he makes a difference, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. He changes everything.
Yeah. What's left of his family, the only one that matters to this story, is Blade. But you do see in the little chap that his father, the evil man, was trying to build in his image, just how successful he might have been in the future.
Well, you want Blade to succeed, and you think that Blue might be a bad seed because he so admires the cruelty and the evil in his father. I mean, he takes to it like a duck to water. And if there is a sequel, which there may be, not this next book, but there may be a sequel at some point. But if there is a sequel, Blade and Blue play prominently.
Yeah. And Blade obviously has a gift of something that's being drawn upon in the book. But you don't quite know where it's going because he's got so much else to contend with before he can relax enough to know who he is.
Yeah, I think if anyone's looking toward the sequel, they might want to sense ahead of time that Blade wouldn't necessarily turn out all wonderful just because he turned out with these people who took an interest and who loved him. He wouldn't necessarily have an easy ride through life, and he wouldn't necessarily make it easy for himself.
Well, he knew what had happened to Swan.
Yes.
And he's hidden it, buried it, but it's lying there.
Well, he only found out what happened by other people saying, because there was no one there to see. But as he's learned things that, you know, then he feels really badly about it.
I know.
But the real damage to him is, as children, we have to feel we have worth. And if someone takes that away from us, knocks it out of our hands, every time we begin to get a grip on it, it's really hard to overcome. And I think as an adult, it's really hard to exercise our demons. We don't even know we have.
Right.
They lurk. And no matter how special somebody is or how much talent they have or how much love and sensitivity they have, they still have these things that they learned before they knew they were learning.
Mm-hmm. And he had plenty of examples.
Yeah.
Then the dreadful thing his father does to Blade that makes Blade lose his eye.
Right.
Was that something that had happened in your story, naturally?
The person that I knew that this is modeled after, I only met as an adult. And so everything I knew about Blade as a child is things that I learned as an adult from people telling me tales.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, that did happen. Something like that happened. Yeah. Not exactly that, but something very similar to that happened.
But my skin began to crawl when I heard the kittens mewing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she was kidnapped and smuggled off. And it wasn't until Blade heard about the cats that he said, my father kills cats. And that's when the adults finally woke up to the evil that was in their midst.
Right.
They'd sensed it, but not to the degree that the children had. And it was clever of you, and I suppose this is something that I wouldn't say clever, it was a natural outcome, that when the events decide the tragedy, Samuel and Swan each separately have an experience that they can't explain, and when they try to, nobody believes them.
Right.
And all the proof that Swan has and knows she was released from all those boundaries and physical ropes and things by mice.
Yeah.
And her father came to her rescue in no explicable way, so they stopped talking about them because there's no point in people just hearing things that are so unbelievable, they don't believe them.
Right. I was a little nervous about having things happen in there that were like, okay, that's got to be a miracle.
And I love the ending, that final chapter after things have begun to be absorbed and settle down slightly. The description of Kala's garden and the way Samuel had picked up on how putting so many unusual things in a garden together made them all glow. Because after all, broccoli growing, nothing but broccoli could get terribly bored with itself.
It's a beautiful garden. I love gardening, and I love just the sight of a garden. Of course, the most beautiful gardens you ever see are those wonderful jumbles of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Flowers and vegetables and berries and everything showing up together. And I could not resist letting that be the garden and letting it be something that Samuel loved, because I think this is probably the one place in the book that I was consciously making a point. I didn't do it to make a point. I did it to just because it was I couldn't resist describing my favorite garden.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it does make a point in that we can save the world if we plant like God planted. God didn't plant things in rows. You know, the Garden of Eden was not planted in rows. If we learn that you don't need insecticide, if you know,
mm-hmm.
marigolds and zinnias can keep the bugs off the tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. So I was really glad that worked naturally into the story, because that's kind of a part of who I am, and it matters.
Well, it was particularly good because Kala was the one, the grandmother, who had started this and that gave the idea, or was deeply in Samuel anyway, and he was going to turn the whole area into a plot that brought everything in. And the two of them suddenly realized that he had seen this, which nobody else had.
Yeah.
And it gave them a link that brought him into the family even more closely than the fact that he had married her daughter.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this was just came to you to do it, but you'd already thought this in mind. When Toy said it was he who had killed Raz.
Right.
And Samuel had to accept it. But it drew the previous tragedy with which Toy had been involved into the climax of the second one, where Toy got release. So the whole book sort of leads to this without you actually knowing it until it happens. And it was almost a happy ever after ending.
Yeah. Yeah, that felt good at the end, but to have the different threads tied up, you know, into, you know, everything's the same until it changes, but look, once it changes, it can still be wonderful.
But the strongest thread in that whole canvas that you created with the children.
Yeah. Because it's so easy to go back to the feelings of a child. You know, that's when we're most intense in our whole lifetime, is when we're kids. Everything is intense. Everything, you know, every smell, every taste, every fear, every bit of happiness, everything is intense. And we remember that as adults. We forget how to do it, but we remember that we did it. We remember what it was like when we were kids. So, in a way, it's easy to write kids as long as you let yourself be honest and not try to make them sound a certain way. If
mm-hmm.
you let them be like they are, then it's easy, because it's so easy to remember how it felt.
Author Jenny Wingfield, whose novel, The Homecoming of Samuel Lake, set in rural South Arkansas in the 1950s, was selected by the Arkansas State Library to be featured in the 2015 If All Arkansas Read the Same Book. It is published by Random House. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.